So Saga is presenting the talk on the commodity this evening. So Saga is a member of one of the Melbourne branches of Socialist Alternative and is also a lecturer at Melbourne University. And there he's quite active in the National Tertiary Education Union. So please make him feel welcome.
Thank you. So commodities are bought and sold for money. And this includes under capitalism, not just goods and services and the means of production, which is factories and raw materials, but also in special ways, labor, land, and money. It's through the exchange of commodities that the capitalist earns a profit, that the laborer secures a wage, the banker secures an interest, the landlord gets a rent. But the commodity is theorized very differently in Marx on one hand and in orthodox economics on the other. So orthodox economics is what you would learn at high school or at university if you took an economics course. It's called neoclassical economics, more technically. I'll use the contrast between these two schools of economic thought to bring out Marx's theory of the commodity. I'll start with a bit of background on orthodox economics. Neoclassical thought is the bedrock of the orthodoxy today. Terms like demand and supply, marginal utility theory, perfect competition, rational choice theory, maximization, general equilibrium, efficient markets hypothesis, all this kind of stuff is the jargon of neoclassical economics. The foundational work for this school of thought was in the 1870s and 1880s, so some time ago. But it rejects the bulk of an older tradition of economic thought, which was called classical political economy. That older tradition consolidated between the 1770s and the 1810s, so just in a 40-year period. And the big names associated with it are Adam Smith and David Ricardo. While Marx was very critical of Smith and Ricardo and significantly amended and developed their theories, he also acknowledged his great intellectual debt to them. And Marx is much closer to their framework than he is to the neoclassical school. The neoclassicals reject the labor theory of value in favor of the theory of marginal utility. They reject a focus on classes, the landlord, the capitalist, the worker. Instead, neoclassical economics talks only about individuals, the satisfaction of individual preferences, consumers, the individual consumer and an individual firm. They also replace a conflictual theory of competition, which manifests long-run order, but only through short-run turbulence and disorder. And they replace that with a theory of competition as passive price-taking, mutually advantageous exchange instead of antagonism between capital and labor, general equilibrium instead of unemployment and crisis, and full employment. So Marx died in the 1880s when neoclassical economics was only just consolidating. But he had seen the precursors of this school of thought, which he called vulgar economics. It's not just a pejorative term, it is, but it's not just that. I'll explain what it means in a sec. Vulgar economics gained increasing traction from 1820 to the 1870s. And this is at the same time that working class organization was really taking hold in the industrial centers of Europe, places like England and France above all. By vulgar, what Marx meant was three things in particular. One, the vulgar economists mistook surface appearances for the underlying reality. Two, they had an idealized view of the capitalist economy. For example, by stipulation, not by observation or deduction, by stipulation, the market reaches an equilibrium of demand and supply. There's full employment, there can't be general overproduction of goods, all this sort of idealizing. That there's harmony between the interests of capital and labor, so we all benefit from a growing economy, that sort of view. And three, that the surface appearances themselves that the neoclassical economists emphasize, sorry, that the vulgar economists emphasize, are appearances seen from the perspective of the capitalist. right? Because appearances might look very different from the perspective of the worker. To the capitalist, it looks like just owning some stocks leads to an increase in capital. So capital looks like a tree. It just, you keep it for a while and it'll bear fruit. Capital appears just as productive of value as labor is in this picture. And the same goes for land and rent. You just own some land, it'll produce some rent. This is very different to the classical approach of a labor theory of value, where it's labor and labor alone that creates value. Profit and rent are a cut taken out of the value produced by labor. And finally, Marx does not see vulgar economics as just some ideology cooked up by pro-capitalist shills to defend their system. Rather, it's understandable why this kind of economic vision might arise because of something that Marx calls the fetishism of commodities. Marx understands fetishism by analogy with religious idols. We create these religious idols, but then we treat them as if they're endowed with some suprahuman power to which humans are subordinated. Specifically with the fetishism of commodities, when we think of the reproduction of capitalist society in terms of the exchange of commodities, social relations between persons, the relation between a boss and a worker, for instance, appear to us not so much as social relations, but relations between persons and things. So a person buys a commodity, that's it, right? You kind of forget about the social relation that ties you to the boss. Ultimately, it's the labor of workers that produces the profits of capitalists. It produces the factories and the machines that they own. It's our labor that creates the batons and pepper spray that police use to break up the pickets and rallies. Our labor underlies the wealth that bankers control and then lend back to us. And yet all these products of our labor appear as something independent of workers, something that oppresses and subordinates us. So we don't own the factories, and so, of course, we have to sell our labor power. It comes to seem natural that we have to be governed by bosses, bankers, and the state. After all, we need to buy commodities to live. And you need to protect private property and social order if you want to create an attractive business climate. How do you do that? Well, you've got to make sure unions aren't too strong so that investors will invest here. You've got to make sure environmental regulations aren't too stringent. Otherwise, you might scare off business and they'll go to a third world country with lax regulations. But all this thing-like naturalness of the economy is misleading. The political economy is a set of social relations, and as free beings, we have some scope in changing and reshaping the social relations. Okay, that's the intro. I want to say a little bit about neoclassical economics first, what its view of the commodity is. Then I want to say a little about use value and value, which is a crucial view of Marx on what the nature of the commodity is. I'll say a little bit about the primacy of production in Marx's view. We can't understand the commodity without understanding the production process. And finally, I'll say a little bit about how class and history are tied into the theory of the commodity for Marx. So first, neoclassical economics. How does the neoclassical school view the commodity? Well, here's four claims to give you a flavor of it. A commodity is something that satisfies demand. Sounds pretty unproblematic. We all likes demands to be satisfied. What's wrong with that? Sounds a bit like democracy, right? You make a demand, you have it satisfied. Two, commodities should be priced by the market. Why is that? Well, market prices are determined by demand and supply, we're told, reflecting on the one hand the preferences of individual workers and firms, and on the other hand scarcity, which is ultimately just set by nature, right? Things are scarce. Generally speaking, preferences are surely something we should try to satisfy. Scarcity ultimately is imposed by nature. Commodity prices are determined by demand and supply in the market. And these forces of demand and supply are presented as impartial between worker and boss, consumer and producer. So the result of this is that we get a magic set of prices which emerge in general equilibrium or perfect competition. And at this magic set of prices, all factors of production, like labor, land, and machinery, are fully used. Each factor of production is where it's most needed. Most needed for what? Most needed for the accumulation of wealth of society. Right? So that's the picture of why we should accept market prices for commodities. Three, orthodox economics talks about capitalism as fundamentally a system in which commodities are exchanged. So exchange is treated as the primary way to understand the economy. Whereas in Marx, it's production that's primary, and exchange is superimposed on top of production. And this exchange itself is characterized as mutually advantageous. So I exchange a commodity that I don't want for a commodity that I do want. Likewise for the person I exchange with. If we didn't both benefit from the exchange, we wouldn't exchange. So production itself is treated as just another form of exchange. It's an exchange of wage labor from the worker for a wage from the capitalist. Again, both of them exchange because they gain something mutually advantageous. If they didn't, they'd walk away from the exchange. Okay, and the fourth point for how neoclassical economics sees the commodity, production and distribution are separated. They're treated as different realms of economic activity, in a sense. So you get this idea that capitalism is good at producing commodities efficiently, and these commodities satisfy demand. That's the production side of things. But then, of course, we see that not everyone can buy things that they demand. There are poor people in the world. But for the neoclassical vision, this is just a matter of the distribution of income. It's not a matter of how the mode of production itself works. So we get the view that the capitalist mode of production is good at producing commodities, let it do that, and then we'll use the welfare state to redistribute the income so that everyone can buy those commodities. Okay, next section, use value and value. Marx talks about the commodity as the cell form of capital. The analogy is a biological cell within the body. Capital is not a thing for Marx. It's not a factory. It's not a share in a company. Capital is better understood as a process, in particular, the process of the self-expansion of value. So a commodity has to be understood not only as a thing, but as part of a dynamic that generates accumulating value. Commodities thus have both a use value and a value. The use value is a specific usefulness of a commodity. So a chair has a use value, a bushel of wheat has a different use value, different sorts of things. Note that this use value is an objective concept, right? So different things have objectively different use values. If you want something to sit on, you don't want the bushel of wheat, you want the chair. It's not a subjective issue, right? By contrast, utility, which we'll get to in a second, marginal utility or preference satisfaction is a subjective thing. All sorts of uses are boiled down to a single metric, utility or preference satisfaction. So that's the use-value side of things. What's value? Marx builds on Adam Smith and David Ricardo's ideas, which posit an objective or materialist theory of value, where value originates in labor. The accumulation of value is the accumulation of labor that has been expended in the past. Generally speaking, you can't accumulate value without producing use values. But the fact that capitalism aims to accumulate value and not use values is very important for understanding the dynamics of capitalism. We won't understand it if we think of it as just producing use values. We have to think of it as essentially, fundamentally producing values. Because periodically, the only way that capitalists can restore the accumulation of value to a healthy pace is by actively leaving wants and needs unmet. So famines, malnourishment, poverty, hordes of unsold goods or money, unemployment, eviction, war, All of these things are a normal part of capitalism. They're not aberrations. They're not a sign of market failure. They're part of how capitalism works. None of these things, obviously, are things that consumers demand or prefer. So the production of use value and the accumulation of value are not only different things, they're also antagonistic things. Sometimes, if you want to keep accumulating value, it requires you to leave some wants and needs unmet. So long as capitalism is in place, we know which of the two is going to win out, right? So when use value and value are in antagonism, we know that the production of value will continue as long as capitalism keeps going. So that's use values which end up suffering. Already, it should be clear that the neoclassical vision of commodities as things that satisfy preferences, or its vision of capitalism as essentially a preference-satisfying machine, is highly ideological. Capitalism, like any mode of production, does produce use values. That's what a mode of production is. And in that respect, like any mode of production, it satisfies some needs and wants for particular use values. But what is central to capitalism is to accumulate value, not producing use values. By contrast, the orthodoxy, the neoclassical economics, has a subjective theory of value. So for neoclassical thinkers, what the capitalist wants to accumulate is the ability to satisfy desires. She wants money for this reason, because it can be exchanged for any commodity one desires. What classical theory distinguishes as use value and value, neoclassical theory conflates together, treating both as the satisfaction of subjective preferences, or the ability to do so through holding money. And this is not just a philosophical issue. Since orthodox theory doesn't track the qualities of the material processes under which surplus labor is extracted, since it treats capital accumulation as simply a quantitative process, not a qualitative one, you put in more inputs and you get out more value, you get out more profits. Because of this, it ends up with no systemic explanation for why capital accumulation periodically requires phenomena like chronic unemployment, economic crisis, overproduction, increasing mechanization of production processes, capital lockouts, and even imperialism. For the orthodoxy, all these phenomena are explained not by the needs of capital accumulation itself, but as external factors that impinge on the market, or which are mere imperfections in the market. They're not due to the market itself. Okay, next section, the primacy of production. We can't understand the realm of production as simply the exchange of equivalent commodities. So one commodity being the wage, and the other commodity being an equivalent amount of labor power. There's more going on in the production process. The capitalist begins with money, exchanges it for commodities of equal value, like machinery, raw materials, and labor power. She manages the production process. There's some product at the end of it. She exchanges this new product for an equal value of money. But by going through this exchange of equivalents, somehow the capitalist ends up with more value than she began with. Right? So how do you end up with more value if you're going through exchanging equivalents? The secret lies in one peculiar commodity, which is unlike all others, labor power. Labor power has the capacity to produce more value than it itself contains. What does it mean to say labor power contains a certain value? It's the value of labor power is the cost of producing the laborer, in a sense. So the food, clothing, shelter, education, and much else that it takes to reproduce a laborer, allow them to keep coming back to work day after day, generation after generation. Much of Capital Volume 1 is about how surplus value is extracted from labor power by the management of the production process. So intensification of work, lengthening of the working day, the introduction of mechanization, both to reduce costs of production and as a response to labor militancy. So the fewer laborers you have, the less it matters how militant the laborers are. For classical political economists and for Marx, production is not an arena of exchange of equivalents. Rather, the worker adds some value to the materials she's given and only receives a fraction of the value added in the form of a wage. The rest of the value added becomes surplus value, which is taken by the capitalist. And from that surplus value, you get profit, interest, rent. Why does the capitalist end up with this surplus value? Well, it required the creation of a class of people who have no means of livelihood except by selling their labor power. This meant pushing people off the land to which they had customary rights, land on which in the past they could have maintained a livelihood of their own without having to do wage labor for someone else. These displaced people now had no option but to accept wage work, sometimes forced labor, for people who now owned the land or who owned the machines in the factories. In Europe, this was the enclosure of the commons happening in many of the European countries. In the settler colonies, it was often genocide against First Peoples, as in Australia. So Aboriginal people who had lived for time immemorial on this land now had to work for the agricultural capitalist as stockmen, shearers, and farmhands. All of this was necessary before capitalists could control the production process. It was necessary before they could start treating the worker as just an instrument, producing a value for the boss. Just as an aside, beyond the economics, there's also philosophical implications of all this stuff. So the production focus is not just about economics, it's also about philosophy. Not only does the capitalist alienate or take away the product that the laborer has created, she begins to restructure the very process of labor, intensifying the labor until it's backbreaking, literally. People broke their backs working. Stripping the labor of all skill, turning it into repetitive, mechanical, and eventually automated actions. For Marx, the human capacity for labor, for shaping our environment according to our plans and our creative visions, whether as individuals or in cooperation with the rest of society, this is fundamental to our species being. It's something that's essential for us to be happy and flourishing as individuals. And this is not just to bemoan the capitalist production process itself, the drudgery and monotony of assembly line work. It also matters what happens to the product of our labor. So workers, as I've said before, workers produce the use value, the very use value that's used to repress us. Right, the batons and pepper spray, the machines that make us redundant. We produce the value that ruling classes pocket as profit and then use to print the right-wing press that indoctrinates workers to accept the system. It finances the electoral campaigns of pro-business politicians. What could have been free, creative, cooperative labor that nourishes the laborer becomes instead the source of the very means that oppress us. This is at the core of what Marx calls the theory of alienation. The flip side of this alienation is that the worker herself appears more and more thing-like, just a cog in the machine, working at whatever pace is set by the machine or by the supervisor, producing whatever interchangeable widget gains the capitalist the most surplus value. This can narrow workers' field of vision so that they forget the agency that they have to use their labor power differently, not only for more fulfilling and creative ends, but also to smash the machines or to overthrow the mode of production, which is, after all, a product of labor, a revolution. Workers can also see one another as thing-like, as mere instruments to be used to satisfy pre-existing wants, to be opposed when their interests clash with yours, instead of seeing fellow workers as comrades with whom you organize in solidarity for common class goals. So to summarize this section on production, what's peculiar to the realm of production is that the laborer can receive the value of her labor power, but nonetheless produce much more value than this, and that more is taken by the capitalist. So long as the capitalist can design the production process adequately. This is crucial to how value increases, and it's fundamental to understanding capitalism that it's not only a system that produces commodities as things, but that it is a system that accumulates value. And it can only accumulate this value most fundamentally through controlling the production process. Okay, next section, class and history. The orthodox view of the commodity reduces its significance to satisfying the preference of the individual consumer. But for Marx, commodities must be understood for their political economic significance, not from the perspective of the individual, but of the class. Marx calls the commodity the cell form of the whole capitalist mode of production. The production and circulation of commodities must be understood from the point of view that they reproduce capitalist class relations as a whole and keep capitalism alive. So let's think of some of the social and historical processes that this requires. One of Marx's analyses is to explain why capitalism produces a relative surplus population as a result, as a normal part of accumulating value. What's a relative surplus population? It's surplus to the needs of capitalist production. Fundamentally, this is because of the enormous productivity of modern production processes. We need relatively few workers to produce the output that can sustain the whole world. But that doesn't mean that the people surplus to the needs of capital are left alone so they can make a life for themselves. No, they're kept dependent on capitalism because capitalism needs them as consumers and as a potential workforce to call upon when needed. The great productivity of the modern age doesn't mean that we all share out the smaller amount of work needed so that everyone can have a livelihood. Rather, a portion of the population is kept unemployed or underemployed, while the employed population is overworked, made to work 40, 60, 80 hours a week. And this is done with the threat that if you don't do your overtime, well, we'll find some unemployed person who very happily will. Unemployment and underemployment is present in every economy, but it is disproportionately in the industrially backward countries. In an industrially advanced country like Australia, the scale of the surplus population is out of sight and out of mind. We produce the goods and export them to industrially backward countries, where our goods take over their markets and put the existing producers out of a livelihood. By 2011, estimates from the International Labour Organization, about 2.4 billion people in the world are unemployed or underemployed. The profitable production of commodities comes to be used to weaken and divide the international working class. Employed versus unemployed, first world workers whose jobs can be offshored to third world workers. Another analysis of Marx's is that there's a tendency toward concentration and centralization of capital into huge multinational corporations in the conglomerates that we see today. Concentration of capital is just capital getting bigger year after year by investing the profits you get into increasing the scale of your firm. Centralization of capital is basically mergers and acquisitions, the powerful capitals taking over the weak capital. Once capitals get so big, they think of competitive strategies on a correspondingly big scale. These capitals become too big to fail. States begin to look after them. Marxist explanations of colonialism, spheres of influence, and imperial wars stem from this basic analysis. The warring over spheres of influence by both capitals and states is often through very specific commodities. So cotton, opium, coal, oil, automobiles, electronic goods like your iPhone, like my iPhone, and weapons. Consider just a couple of examples from the early decades of the Industrial Revolution, which was built on the back of one type of commodity above all in England, which is cotton textiles. So the early Industrial Revolution, I'm really talking about the early 1800s in England. In the 1830s, Egypt, under its ruler Muhammad Ali, became the first country outside of Europe and North America to begin industrialization. It was already a large cotton producer on its quite fertile lands, and it became a large producer of cotton textiles. Gradually, it began eating into the markets of British textile manufacturers in parts of Europe. So Britain went to war in 1840 to defeat Ali, to deindustrialize the country, forcibly shut down the mills, to eliminate it as a competitor for British textile manufacturers. It turned Egypt into an exporter of raw cotton alone, rather than a manufacturer of cotton textiles. This kind of story is often repeated by various colonial powers about very specific commodities all over the world, and it's part of the explanation why there emerged a pattern of a global periphery as a supplier of raw materials and a global core that produced the industrial manufacturers. As the Industrial Revolution took hold in Britain in the early decades of the 1800s, there was a great upsurge in demand for industrial lubricants, right? So machines were being used, they seize up if you don't lubricate them. The main lubricant then was palm oil, which was sourced almost entirely from Nigeria. But British merchants only got the palm oil at the coast, while Nigerian kings and Nigerian merchants controlled the production of the palm oil and its transport down the Niger River to the coast. But once there was this surge in demand for palm oil from British industry, this slow process was not good enough anymore. It was too slow. It was too costly because the Nigerian kings and merchants obviously took a big cut. And so the British Navy stepped in to begin its conquest of Nigeria. The point is, competition to produce commodities more profitably was the impetus behind armed force to acquire specific raw material commodities or to eliminate competing producers of a specific commodity. Or, yet again, to open up a foreign market for the sale of a specific commodity produced by firms in your country. Notice that we've gone from production in a factory to the prospects of the entire working class and to imperial wars. The course of history is, in important ways, shaped by the intercapital and interstate competition involving commodities. For Marxists especially, but even for the classical political economists before Marx, economics cannot be separated off from history, politics, sociology. By contrast, within the neoclassical orthodoxy in social science, economics separates itself off from these other disciplines. Economics is one thing, history is a separate thing. For them, the production of commodities is a purely technical issue of efficiency. The sorts of material relations that this actually requires is treated as outside the scope of economics. The actual flows of commodities, the requisite relations between capital and labor, between advanced states and dependent states. All these things are for some other discipline, like history, sociology, international relations, social psychology. Wars and spheres of influence are left to be explained as the results of great persons of state or rival ideologies. Why centers of industry or finance are located in one part of the world rather than another are left to be explained as a result of social psychology, the entrepreneurial ethic, liberal individualism, Judeo-Christian values, right? Not economics. Okay, just to wrap up, conclusion. So commodities are not simply use values, things that satisfy wants. Most importantly for capital, they're means of continued accumulation of capital and the means of reproducing class society. The production process is continually changed not to produce better use values, but to extract more surplus value. The mix of use values that is produced as commodities isn't determined by some sort of survey about what individuals want or need. It's determined above all by inter-capital competition and interstate competition. Capitals become more competitive by securing access to key commodities like oil or cotton and access to markets. And states, which are dependent on the capital accumulated within their jurisdiction, help out their capitals with police, armies, trade agreements. Commodities must be understood not as mere things, but also in terms of the social relations that underpin them. But precisely because of this, we can't leave a discussion of the commodities on a grim note. as if we can only deplore these social relations as being materialistic or exploitative or alienating. Because after all, the same social relations also carry a potential for the future realization of a communist world. Orthodox theory would like you to think that capitalism is a system of individuals, an individual decision to offer up my labor power, receiving an individual wage, which I exchange for a very specific commodity that I desire. But in fact, capitalism is highly cooperative. And that is part of its secret, part of the secret of its great productivity. The productivity comes ultimately from the cooperation of larger and larger numbers of workers within a production process. It's not some magic that's due to the market. It's because of cooperation, most fundamentally. Hundreds of thousands cooperate in a single production chain within large corporations today. So when apathetic pessimists snigger at Marxists, as they often do, because we hope for a communist society of cooperation, Marxists answer that the cooperation is already there in embryo. Across borders, across languages, religions, nationalities, it's there already in the productive forces of society. The problem is that these cooperative forces of production are fettered, strangled, kept in check by the fact that the means of production are owned by the capitalists. Really, the commodity is too important to leave at the service of the capitalist class. No matter how productive technology is, capitalism will never meet all ends because that's not the aim of the system. The organized working class must seize the productive forces of society. The production of use values must be liberated from the yoke of the accumulation of value, must be liberated from the task of reproducing class society.